Thou will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you'd like to become a Patreon sponsor for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, just go to our official website, which is bodybuildinglegendsshow.com. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the link to becoming a Patreon donor. All right, welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we don't have any guests, so I'm going to do something a little bit different. Sometimes I'll read old articles from the magazines, and I got an email from Pat Comer, who's a big contributor to the show. Every time I need some pictures for something, Pat usually sends them to me. But Pat suggested that I read the quotes in the book Pumping Iron. If you've read the book Pumping Iron, on the side of each page, not each page, but throughout the book, there are quotes from everybody, from Arnold to Franco to Steve Mihalik, Lou Ferrigno, Bill Pearl. And so he said it would be a great show just to read those quotes. So I thought that was a great idea. So I took out my book, Pumping Iron, the original one from 1974, and I was looking through it, and I kind of made an outline of the book. So I thought we could just go through the book, Pumping Iron. For those of you who have never read it, this should be a real treat for you. The writing by Charles Gaines was superb. Photographs by George Butler were outstanding. This is still a fantastic book all these years later. And the book has recently been republished. It's actually Rick Newcomb's publishing company, and he now has it available on Amazon for like $20. So if you guys have never seen the book Pumping Iron, you should really check it out. But on this show, like I said, we are going to go through the book Pumping Iron. I'm going to read some passages from the book. And like Pat said, I'm going to read all those quotes that are on the side of the book, which should take about a regular show. So this should be interesting. All right, so what else is going on in your world, guys? We've got some bad news in the bodybuilding world. Franklin Green, the great bodybuilder from the 1970s, passed away last week. I'm not sure how old Franklin was. I was trying to find out, and I couldn't find anything. But Franklin was in all those IFBB shows in the late 60s, early 70s. I'm writing this book, Bodybuilding History, and I'm running over Franklin's name all the time in a lot of these contests because he was a big contributor to all of the early IFBB shows when they were held at the Brooklyn Academy of Music and then into the 1970s. Just looking at his contest history here on Muscle Memory, 1967, Franklin was third in the Mr. World, the IFBB Mr. World. And then he did some WBBG shows. And in 1972, he won the medium class in the Mr. World. That was the year that Mike Katz won the overall. And that's when Mike went over to the Mr. Universe that year. But Franklin won the medium class over Steve Burnett and Javier Medina from Mexico. And then in 1973, Franklin took second in the medium class to Bob Birdsong at the Mr. America. And that was the year that Lou Ferrigno won the contest. And then in 1974, Franklin again won the medium class at the Mr. World. So the Mr. World was his show. And Bill Grant won the overall that year. And he competed again in the Mr. World in 1975, but he got second to Darcy Beckles, a great bodybuilder from Barbados, of course. And then it says Franklin even competed as a pro bodybuilder in 1979, 1981 in the Night of the Champions, which I don't really remember. And he did the Mr. International in 1981, but he only got 14. So by that time, his career was probably pretty much over with. And I believe Franklin was in the film Stay Hungry. I just looked up the IMDb, and I was looking for his name because I thought he had a speaking part. I thought he said something in there, but I didn't see anything. So maybe one of our listeners will correct me on that. If you know that Franklin was in the film Stay Hungry, I'm pretty sure he said a line in that movie. But there was something I wanted to read to you guys from Facebook. This was called A Tribute to Franklin Green, The Hummingbird Smile. It was written by Anthony Blake. And he says, I am Tony Blake, a devoted close friend. I've known Mr. Franklin Green over 30 plus years. It was within my teenage years in the 80s when our friendship blossomed. It all started at the old Mid-City Gym on West 49th Street in New York City. It was the connection of Caribbean flavor and the American dream and getting to know one another, a fond friendship that came to be. It was Franklin's bodybuilding efforts where I got to know and gained exposure to his bodybuilding ventures. He showed me the concepts and his determinations. I read about Franklin Green from various magazines such as Muscle and Fitness and Muscle Training Illustrated. I saw the life of Franklin Green come to life, close and personal. Mr. Green was known as the bodybuilder's friend throughout his bodybuilding career. Franklin won scores of bodybuilding awards from IFBB Mr. World twice, Mr. Eastern America, Mr. Western Hemisphere, Mr. West Indies, and many more. It was that Green name with the E at the end for excellence, the F in Franklin for fulfillment. It was Frank's smile that captivated me and caught my attention, being full of warmth and sincerity. Frank had a name for me being Blakey after my last name of Blake. So where did he derive that name from? Simply Lord Blakey. Mr. Green will say that proudly everything he saw in me and called, Franklin saw me greater and I took it with honor. His personal characteristics were determined, inspired, vision, mission, spiritual, and warrior. Yes, warrior. Franklin worried about a lot of things and he even worried about me. I always said, I worry about you. I responded, buddy, don't worry about me as I am in good hands of God's all state of heaven's authority. Whenever Franklin called me, his words would be, am I okay? I assured him I am fine. Franklin worried about other people beside himself. I was given some important names by the master himself as friendship wasn't enough. It went into advisor, consultant, counselor, etc. Before he could suggest it, yes, the doctor is in. Sometimes Franklin would get into numerous jams and then worry and call me for help. Like a superhero, it was assurance to the rescue. Yet I had to ask him a question. How did you get into this jam? Franklin's response, I don't know. Assurance was not defeated. One day I told him I was worried about something and Franklin, stop worrying, you will be fine. He threw back at me what advice I threw at him. All I could say, I taught you well. Franklin was full of jokes and laughter. He said he wanted his friends to feel as good as he did. That was Frank's punchline. Several times he said to me, I don't want you to ever die. I replied, God controls the hourglass and I couldn't promise that. As long as grace and mercy mounts, I will be here for you. I did notice Franklin was getting a little depressed as he wanted a car and going back to lifting those weights so bad. My buddy always wanted to be independent and being what he's always done. I called Franklin every day to check on him and he did the same of me. His reply would be, thank you. Thank you for the memories and caring approaches. You were like an older brother to me. We will meet again at the pearly gates, a day to rejoice, to acquaint once more. Blakey will always be remembered in high honor and superior accord, a living soul with a true heart. To the Green family, stay together and be connected for each other. That's what Franklin Green would want. He will be watching from above. This is not goodbye, but until we meet again. All right. Obviously written by a good friend of his, Anthony Blake. So thank you, Anthony, for sharing that. He did that on Ken Budeau's website, Facebook, Classic Bodybuilding 60s through the 80s. So check that out. So Franklin had great physique back then, but he unfortunately passed away. So another legend has left us. All right. So that's all I got, guys. I don't have any emails from you guys from last time. We did the show 2 weeks ago and we did the magazine readings. So I am trying to get some more guests on the show. I've been reaching out to a lot of people this week, so hopefully we'll get some next week for next week's show. But until that time, let me read some excerpts from the great book, Pumping Iron. This was the original book. I've got the original one right in front of me here. I'm going to read from it. It was published in 1974 by Simon & Schuster, 221 pages, and Leon Brown is in the first picture here. They got a lot of pictures in here that are full pages or sometimes double pages. And it is dedicated to, it says this book is dedicated to the people and sport it describes, and particularly to Joe Disco. So let me go through the layout of the book. It starts off with an introduction by Charles Gaines, of course, and then the book Pumping Iron starts. So it's broken down into two big parts. Part one is the training, and then part two is the competition. So basically what Pumping Iron covers, besides describing the sport of bodybuilding, is it covers the 1972 IFBB Mr. Universe, which took place in Baghdad, Iraq, and Ed Corney and Mike Katz were the American competitors, so they went down there. So Charles and George went with Mike and Ed, and they covered them, and they talked to them, and they had a great report about that throughout the book. And then they also covered the following year, the 1973 Mr. Olympia contest, which took place in New York. So they lived in Venice, California that year, and they trained at Gold's, and they watched Franco and Arnold and all the other guys, because there was also the Mr. America and Mr. World contest that year as well. I think Ken Waller won the Mr. World that year, and then Lou Ferrigno won the Mr. America. So they were covering that as well. So part one, like I said, is the training. Chapter one is called Mr. Olympia number one. And throughout the book, they will alternate between Mr. Olympia chapters and Mr. Universe chapters as they tell the story. So it's interesting. It begins with Serge Nouvre's posing routine on stage at the 1973 Mr. Olympia. And then the ending of the book is Arnold posing at that same contest in 1973 at the Mr. Olympia. And they compare Serge's routine to Arnold's routine. And basically what they say about Serge is that he kind of lost his audience as he was going through his routine. So I'll just read an excerpt from the book from chapter one. It says, Nouvre waits for a moment for the noise level to rise and then begins with a set of swooping side shots, putting his best up front in front of the judges right away. The tiny waist vacuum into a comma, the unusually high and well-formed pectorals that slope from his collarbones like hogback riches, the cantaloupe-sized deltoids, and the arms. Nouvre's arms, it is clear, are as dangerous as they are reputed to be. Massive, symmetrical, the muscles cleanly divided and balanced. No disappointment there. And the crowd tentatively begins to hype. He does the single bicep pose with his right arm, keeping his left behind him, fist cocked at the hip in a tricep flex, holds it, and pivots to face the judges to begin his front shots. But with the turn, something mysteriously escapes Nouvre's routine. Vitality seeps fatally from it like gas from a souffle. That was great. So yeah, chapter one is only 13 pages and basically starts off with Serge Nouvre's routine. And then it goes into introducing Arnold and Franco at Gold's Gym. And there's some great pictures of them training. So let me read the quotes that are on the side of the book in chapter one. So the chapter starts off with a quote from Carl Shapiro, and it says, "The body, what is it, Father, but a sign to love the force that grows us, to give back. What in thy palm is senselessness and mud?" And then Edmund Spencer, there's a quote from him. It says, "For soul is form, and doth the body make." And then it has Arnold's stats here. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Mr. Europe, AU, Mr. World, 5 times Mr. Universe, 4 times, and the current Mr. Olympia, 26 years old, 6'2", 240 pounds, 57-inch chest, 22-inch arms, 31-inch waist, 28-inch thighs, and 20-inch calves. And I'm sure the average person who didn't know anything about bodybuilding in 1974 when they're reading this book had a freak out reading those measurements. And then they got Franco's measurements right on the next page. Franco Colombo, Mr. Italy, Mr. Europe, 3 times IFBB Mr. Universe, and 3 times IFBB Mr. World. So those stats are wrong. Franco only won the Mr. Universe once, which was in 1970. And when did Franco win the Mr. World? Well, he won the 1970 AAU Mr. World. Yeah, and then Franco won the IFBB Mr. World in 1970. So he was a 2-time Mr. World, but it says 3 times IFBB Mr. World, so that's wrong. It says he was 30 years old, 5'5", tall, 185 pounds, 50-inch chest, 19-inch arms, 30-inch waist, 26-inch thighs, 17.5-inch calves. I think they got his age wrong, too, because Franco was born in 41, and Arnold was born in 47, so that's a 6-year difference. And they said Arnold is 26, so Franco must have been 32. All right, so the first quote is from Franco, and it says, "Chuck Sipes was strong, but I am much stronger than him, very much stronger than him, all around. Because he was strong on the bench press, I'm strong in everything. Any kind of movement you can find in the gym, I can beat everybody in." And then there's a quote from Arnold, and it says, "When I was 10 years old, I got this thing that I wanted to be the best in something, so I started swimming. I won championships, but I always felt I couldn't be the best. I tried it in skiing, but there I felt like I didn't have the potential. I tried soccer, but I didn't like that too well because there I didn't get the credit alone if I did something special. I just avoided team sports from then on. Then I started weightlifting through the other sports, and I enjoyed it the most. I won the Austrian championship in 1964, but I found out that I was just too tall. So I quit that, and I went into bodybuilding. 2 years later, I found out that's it. That's what I can be the best in." All right, so that's the only quotes they have in chapter one. There's a couple other sections here in chapter one I wanted to go over. It says, inside Nubre's competition, the other two contestants for the Mr. Olympia title are beginning the morning of their own type of training. Outsized diagrams of railroad cars join in a frieze about the mirrored wall. Beneath them, Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Austrian Oak, is happily pushing 315 pounds 12 times off his supine self. Smooth, flat back repetitions, the black Olympic bar falls to his chest, pauses, rises. Three 45-pound plates, big as manhole covers, jiggling at either end. Schwarzenegger is the current Mr. Olympia. He also happens to be the best bodybuilder alive and very possibly the most perfectly developed man in the history of the world. He came to this country in 1968 from Graz, Austria, brought over by the American muscle entrepreneur named Joe Weider. When Weider found him, Schwarzenegger had been a competitive swimmer, soccer player, skier, boxer, wrestler, shot putter, and javelin thrower. He had been the weightlifting champion of Austria and the curling champion of Europe. He was Mr. Europe and Mr. Universe, and he was all of 21 years old. Now at 26, he has won five Mr. Universe titles and the last three Olympias, and he has not lost a contest since 1969. It is a record of total domination in bodybuilding that compares with Pele's in soccer, or Mersic's in cycling, or Keeley's in skiing. That kind of outrageous superiority is always subject to demeaning imputations. And there are people around who will tell you that Schwarzenegger injects himself with silicone or that he uses truckloads of anabolic steroids. The truth is simply that he was born with more physical talent, is smarter at the sport, and works at it with more joy and fierceness than any other bodybuilder in history. That and one other thing. He's wanted to be the best at something, the very best, since he was 10 years old. All right, chapter two does not have a Mr. Olympia or Mr. Universe title. It just says chapter two. And it basically talks about all the gyms in America at the time, the famous gyms like Mid-City Gym. And then it also, of course, talks about YMCAs. And then it talks about Mike Katz and where he trains in Connecticut. And it says the very best places to do bodybuilding, though, are the few gyms run just for bodybuilding by someone who doesn't care particularly about overweight businessmen. These places, like the very best bars, never make all the money they could make, and sometimes they don't make any money at all, which probably accounts for why there are so few of them. I have been to only two of these places. One is gone now. It was in Birmingham, Alabama. Gold's Gym is the other one and is doing fine out in Venice. And then they talk about Gold's Gym, and this, of course, was the original Gold's Gym that was created by Joe Gold, but I don't believe Joe owned it at this time. I think he had already gotten rid of it. But they do a great job in this chapter of really describing what the gym is all about. And then they go into a little more training with Arnold at that 9 o'clock training session, 9 a.m. training session on that Monday, where he's training chest and back and calves. And they talk about the pump and they talk about the things going on in the gym. So let me see if there's any quotes from this chapter. All right. So the first quote is from Lawrence Samuel, who was a great bodybuilder in the 1970s, a very thick African-American bodybuilder. I'm surprised he never went any farther because he was very thick. He had a great physique. He said, they say we are muscle-bound and freaks. Well, I'll tell you the truth, man. I never pay too much attention to these people. The more they talk, that's the more I'm going to continue working out because that's the way I feel about it. It's the thing I want to do, and I'm going to continue. I don't care what they say. I think it's a very good thing, and I'm going to continue with it as long as the Lord leaves me breath and I have the strength to go along with it. I'm going to be doing it all the time. And then Bill Pearl, the great Bill Pearl, they have a picture of him and they have a quote from him. He says, I would spend an hour a day, maybe a year in advance of a contest just on posing, a year in advance. I used to pose to music all the time. I would work at it just like a dance step. The music was part of my routine. The lighting was a part of it. It was like being on the Ed Sullivan show. It was an act. I had an act and I stuck with this act like a professional artist. Everywhere I went, I had my own lighting, my own staging, my own platform, everything. And then this quote from Franco, I thought this was funny. He says, like one time I was on the beach here and a girl was with a guy. She says to him, look, this body, what a nice body this man has. And I says, thank you very much. And the guy says, ah, it's just weak, weak muscles. And I went to him and I say, why you say that? I say, I'm stronger than you. I can show it to you. I can lift something and show you I'm much stronger than you. And I can also do athletic stuff, but you can't do it. I said, let's go to the platform. I'll show you. And then he starts getting upset. He says, yeah. He says, I'll beat the shit out of you. He said it. So I grabbed him by the neck. I said, listen, never say this again in your life. Then his girlfriend says, okay, okay. Now you can leave him alone. Franco. And then here's, of course, the famous quote from Arnold, which he also said in the movie Pumping Iron. He said, bodybuilding should be fun because I get a feeling of satisfaction, which is very hard to explain. A bodybuilder knows that when he pumps up his muscles, it means the muscles grow. So therefore, he knows when he pumps up well, that is progress. And that satisfies him because he feels the progress in his body. Therefore, the pump feels good. It's actually the best feeling a bodybuilder can have. It's a difficult thing to explain. Like sometimes we joke around and we get a good pump and we say, you have to admit that a good pump is better than coming. Somebody off the street wouldn't understand that, but sometimes a pump is the best feeling you can have. There's a great picture of Arnold doing curls with his arm blaster. The pictures in this book are just amazing. But that was a funny quote because I remember when I bought this book, Pumping Iron, I think I was about 11 or 12 years old. I didn't even know what coming meant. So I remember I asked my mom, What does this mean? What's he talking about here? And I forget what she said, but my mom diplomatically said, no, that's just when you feel good or something like that. All right, here's another quote from Arnold. He says, you don't really see a muscle as a part of you in a way. You see it as a thing. You see it as a thing and you say, well, this thing has to be built a little longer. This bicep has to be longer or the tricep has to be thicker here in the elbow area. And you look at it and it doesn't even seem to belong to you, like a sculpture. Then after looking at it, a sculptor goes in with this thing and works a little bit, and you do maybe then some extra force reps, get this lower part out. You form it, just like sculpture. Then the final quote by Arnold in this chapter, he says, this is a great quote. I love this quote. The better you get, the less you run around showing off as a muscle guy. You know, you wear regular shirts, loose shirts, not always trying to show what you have. You talk less about it. It's like you have a little BMW. You want to race the hell out of the car because you know it's just going 110. But if you see guys driving a Ferrari or a Lamborghini, they slide around at 60 on the freeway because they know if they press that accelerator, they're going to go 170. These things are the same in every field. And then they talk about Arnold's workout here, and they said at the end of his workout, he says before he does all that and before he showers, he walks over to one of the big mirrors and takes off his shirt. The gym goes even quieter than it was before. And everyone's still in it, stops with whatever he's doing. Looking thoughtful, Arnold turns his right calf forward and flexes it, watching in the mirror as the cleft muscle leaps into complicated relief. He twists it, studies it. Then he does the same thing with his left calf. Then he jerks both arms straight in front of him and flexes his chest. And the motion seems to throw a fine, sharp spray of excitement around the room. The men standing behind him watch the mirror in the same elated, adrenalized way you would watch a fight as Arnold checks himself through five or six quick poses, his face now grinning and appraising wolfishly. They are all bodybuilders, a few of them very good ones, and they have seen Arnold pose before, yet they stare at the reflection like the ladies on Santa Monica Beach when they see a builder for the first time. It's not just his size that does this to people. There are a number of bodybuilders around who are as big and a couple who are bigger. More than that, it is the perfect balance of everything, of biceps to calves, shoulders to waist, thighs to chest, and the clarity and detail of every part. Another thing is the naturalness and grace of his body. Most of the other very big builders, like young Lou Ferrigno, who has the greatest size ever but no polish, yet look as if they have been built up with a trowel. The muscles look stuffed and worried into place, but each of Arnold's body parts, though huge, is subtly refined. As sleek and graceful looking as the hind leg of a thoroughbred racehorse. great writing, right? Unbelievable writing by Charles. I love how he could look at the bodybuilding world or look at bodybuilders and be able to express it in a way that the average person could understand. All right, chapter 3 is where they start talking about the Mr. Universe, and this is where we get introduced to Ed Corney and Mike Katz. They are in Baghdad at this point, and this chapter talks about them waking up in their hotel room. There's some great pictures of Ed and Mike in their hotel room in their bed just waking up. And then they talk about them, introduce them to the audience. So they have Mike Katz here. It says 1971 to 72 IFBB Mr. America, which he only won it in 72 or 70. I'm sorry. He won it in 70, not 71, 72. And then it says 1972 to 73 IFBB Mr. World. And Mike won that one in 1972. 29 years old, 6'1", 240 pounds, 58 inch chest, 21 inch arms, 31 inch waist, 29 inch thighs, and 18 inch calves. Ed Corney, 1972 to 73 IFBB Mr. America. I believe Ed won it in 72. Yeah, which was the same year that this universe was being held. And then it says 72 to 73 IFBB Mr. Universe. So they kind of gave it away that Ed won. He was 40 years old at this point, 5'6 and a half, 170 pounds, 48 inch chest, 19 inch arms, 29 inch waist, 26 inch thighs, and 17 inch calves. All right. So the first quote is from Mike Katz. It says, you know, my whole life seems, and I'm not feeling sorry for myself, but Nancy knows. She's been with me all my life. It always seems. I don't know whether it's because I've got a Jewish name or what it is, but it always seems like people have picked on me. You know, always trying to find fault with me, constantly not giving me credit. Right from when I started playing peewee baseball, you know, I could throw a ball faster. I could run faster. I could do different things better, but I'd never start off, you know, play the whole game. And I always had that damn feeling as a youngster. You know, I think sometimes that maybe why I'm doing what I'm doing is to get back at some. I don't know whether it's unconscious, but just to show the world, those people that made fun of me. And I was bullied quite a bit when I was a kid too, you know. It's a funny thing, but I can remember, and it sounds really weird. I had this bike. It was a real nice bike, you know. Kids are impressed with bikes when they're young. That's the big thing. And I can remember the fenders of the bike getting rusty. I never told anybody this. And I can remember the kids bothering me. Oh man, just bothering me about it. And another thing, I couldn't read that well. I had eye problems. And you know how kids can be really mean. My eyes sometimes crossed. I had two operations and the kids used to make fun of my eyes and they used to make fun of the bumpers on my bicycle. Little things. And like there was a lady in school. She was a guidance teacher. Her name was Mrs. Bassett. Nancy remembers. And she told me I would never be able to become a college graduate, that it was impossible, that I just didn't have the intelligence and I should take up industrial arts. And man, you know, from that peewee coach in baseball knocking me to people in school, I used to cry. In seventh grade, I can remember the math teacher used to make fun of me and be sarcastic. And the reading teacher used to put me in the rottenest reading group. Man, you know, those things I can remember as a kid did a hell of a lot to make me push and show everybody that I could do it. I think that's probably one of the, you know, had a lot to do with me wanting to achieve this greatness I want to achieve. Just to say, hey, look at me now. You know, you made fun of me then, but look what I turned into. They used to call me Porky too. That was another thing they used to make fun of. Wow. So obviously Mike mentioned that in the movie Pumping Iron, but he didn't go into that kind of detail. So that was great. Ed Corney says, well, most people think that bodybuilders are strictly after their body and appearance only. I find that isn't true. That's only half of it. The other half is coming on rather strong and developing yourself mentally as well. A broad outlook on life, the trials and tribulations, ups and downs, you know, you're able to take things as they come and go. I also want to read this little bit that Charles wrote about Ed Corney. This is when he introduces him. He said, at 39, Ed Corney is 11 years older than Mike Katz and does not look even a bit vulnerable. He looks cheerful and self-possessed and gentle in the way genuinely tough men usually do. About a year after the time in Baghdad, I was at a party in New York restaurant with Ed when an uptown lady began to needle him. She was sitting next to him and was a little drunk and maybe didn't know how to talk decently to him, and she began calling him Mr. Corney and began needling him about what he does for a living. What he does is bounce thoroughly and as nicely as it makes any sense to do that job at a nightclub called Mr. Magoo's in San Jose, California. Ed listened to her say she had never known a bouncer before and what a charming thing that was to do, and answered her when she asked him what he thought about when he bounced, smiling at her and calling her ma'am, but not in the same way she was calling him mister. He had paid out of his own pocket to come to New York for a contest he had not won. He was only 2 months off a big knee operation and 6 off a second divorce. He needed her kind of talk like another bad knee, but he could see that this lady smoked and drank too much, and in her small, sharp face, she was a lot worse off than he was. He was born and raised in Hawaii, and his own face is broad, vaguely Asian, and very expressive, especially when he's posing. He got into bodybuilding late, and he's had good luck with it, but a lot of bad luck in other parts of his life. One of the pieces of that good luck was that he learned how to pose from Clancy Ross, and now nobody poses with more joy, triumph, and beauty than Ed Corney does. He doesn't have Katz's education, but he is bright and very articulate about things that are important to him. He doesn't talk at all about things that aren't. I love how he's able to capture these guys' personality and just his great writing. All right, let me see if there's any other quotes in here. It talks about the dinner they had in Iraq. This was before the contest started. This was basically when Ed and Mike just got to Iraq and they were getting settled in. All right, chapter 4 is another one that's just not about the universe or the Olympia. This is basically about training and diet for a bodybuilder, and this one is the one that talks to Steve Mihalik. Now, Steve Mihalik in these pictures is very normal-looking. In fact, I remember when I read this book and they said he was Mr. America, I couldn't believe it by looking at the picture because Steve looks like he never touched a weight in his life in these pictures. So this first quote is from Steve Mihalik. It says, listen, I've been on countless TV shows, given countless lectures, and traveled all over the country for nothing on behalf of youth groups and other organizations just to try to change the image of what people thought a muscle man or bodybuilder was. But they all would say, well, fine, great. There's ripples. There's lumps. That's, you know, what for? A lot of people who have been honest with me have told me that there's an insecurity being around someone who's physically overpowering. And then Steve has another quote here. Then there's the off days. You're stuck with this off day, right? Well, what are you going to do with the off day? Well, I might as well do my calves, and I might as well do my waistline. I might as well do my forearms. I might as well do incidentals. I might as well work on definition. I might as well work on posing. You know, I might as well run to the library and learn more about what I should be eating at this particular time. Learn about metabolism, you know? And meanwhile, while I'm doing this, there's my wife sitting home going bananas. And my mother, the clergy at the church, and everyone saying, you know, what are you doing? Take a day off. I say, okay, fine. Sundays, I'm going to rest. Sundays, I find myself doing one-legged calf raises on a street corner somewhere. Because when I'm up on that stage, I'm there by myself, me alone. I'm not up there with a baseball bat. I'm not up there with a football. I'm there with just me, my body. And there's a couple more from Steve here. It says, most women I've met think you're nice to look at, and you may be great in bed once, just for the experience. But no way I want to know you. No way I want to keep a relationship with you or be seen with you. This is most of the women I met. And then this one says, I've been married for 7 years and my wife could care less whether I look like a Greek statue. At one point I did. My structure was so symmetrical that I had painters and sculptors corner me just to copy me. She could care less. She could care less whether I had a pot belly or what. And then it's got Steve's stats here. It says, Steve Mihalik, 1972 AAU Mr. America, 26 years old, 5'10", 230 pounds, 52-inch chest, 20-inch arms, 27-inch waist. Wow. 26-inch thighs, 19-inch calves. So this must have been interviewed. They must have took these pictures of Steve like a year after he won the America. That's unbelievable. He lost so much size. And then one final quote here. This chapter is kind of short. It's only 7 pages. It says, I was interested in the beauty of the male physique and showing the beauty of the male physique to whoever had paid to come see it. So I would move to music and pose and do sort of ballet and go down and twist and forward just so it would look almost like if you looked at a lion running through the jungle. Sometimes if you catch a lion or a horse or a doe, they're so beautiful just the way they move. And I would try to incorporate this in my posing. Definitely not putting any real muscly, veiny type poses in there because I don't want to turn anybody off. I just wanted to bring the beauty of the male physique across because I really feel the male physique is just as beautiful, if not more beautiful than the females. Now, horses, the male is prettier. Male lion, the peacock. I love women and everything, but, well, look at me. I just feel that a man has as much to offer as a woman. All right, chapter 5 goes back to the Mr. Universe called Mr. Universe number 2, and this one covers the prejudging of the 1972 Mr. Universe that Mike and Ed were in. So the first quote here on the side is from Mike Katz. It says, why does this particular thing turn people off? I believe that people should be built the way I'm built. I don't think people should walk around looking like a piece of junk. I've got normal clothes on. If they fit tight, maybe it's because I can't afford clothes that don't fit tight. I don't have anything showing that shouldn't be showing. Some guys walk around really freaky, but that turns me off too. When I go to the beach, I have these little areas where nobody goes but seagulls. Nobody bothers me. I want to compete. I want to be the greatest in the world. If that's wrong, it's wrong. And then another quote here from Mike. Sometimes when you're working out in the gym and you're so much more developed and, you know, unbelievable in comparison to anybody working out around you, you say to yourself, man, am I real? Is it possible that I really am this big? And sometimes, you know, I'll gander at the mirror when I see some little guy who's working pretty hard go by and I'll say, that's ridiculous. How can this be possible? Then I'll find myself looking for defects in the mirror, you know, to see if I'm really that big or if there may be a mistake, you know, a wave in the mirror that makes you look bigger. I don't get hung up thinking about it, but sometimes I do. You know, you're not normal because normal is 6 feet tall, 150, 160 pounds, you know, fairly skinny or a big fat person. So that you know that because you're superiorly built and you've trained and developed that way, that you do look odd. I mean, you do look unreal. These are great quotes because you have to put it in the context of when this book was written in 1972, 1973. And this is way before the general public got into lifting weights. So bodybuilders really were looked at as freaks, as something that was a total oddity. Just to see anybody around walking around with a good build or having muscles was very, very unusual. People didn't work out anywhere near as like they do today. In fact, in that chapter about the gyms, Charles was talking about how there's so very few gyms in all of America that were really bodybuilding gyms. All right, here's another quote from Mike. It says, he, Ed Corney, has a slightly more finished physique than I do. He's a little rounder. You know, he's got no weak points, and my arms could be slightly bigger. My calves could be bigger. And his physique, he's not overwhelming. He's not huge or dynamic as far as his physique goes, but he's just very symmetrical. You look to try to find flaws in him, and there's very, very little you can find. Of course, Ed did go on to beat Mike. Mike won his class, and Ed won his class, and then Ed won the overall. All right, next chapter is chapter number 6. It is Mr. Olympia number 2, and this is basically following Arnold to Venice Beach and just talking to him and showing the impact or talking, writing about the impact that Arnold had on the regular people at Venice Beach. So this was really cool. Some great shots in here. Of course, the famous one where Arnold's got the nude girl on his shoulders. I think that was taken out in some of the later editions. So Arnold has another great quote here. It says, there are some girls who are turned on by my body and some others who are turned off. But for the majority, I just use it as a conversation piece. Like someone walking a cheetah down 42nd Street would have a natural conversation piece. Then when they get to talking to me, they see I'm not mean, but gentle. So that's all they really want to know. And then Arnold, another quotable quote here. When a homosexual looks at a bodybuilder, I don't have anything against that. I would probably stare the same way if Raquel Welch or Brigitte Bardot walked by. If I see a girl with big tits, I'm going to stare and stare. And I'm going to think in my mind what I'm going to do with her if I would have her. The same is true with the homosexual. He's looking at the bodybuilder and picturing what he would do with them. You have to face it if you have a good body, and it's somehow a compliment to a bodybuilder. Sometimes girls are attracted to your body. Sometimes homosexuals are attracted to your body. And then this one here, he says, I have a good sense of my body in a bathing suit around people who appreciate what I'm doing, like a contest. Then I'm proud. On television, I am proud. But on the beach, most people are not experts. The general public doesn't know how to look. How proud can you be when they don't even know what they're looking at? And they got the great two-page picture of Arnold just laying on the beach in 1973, Mr. Olympia shape. All right, so I want to read a couple of paragraphs from this chapter too. They talked about Arnold and all his friends from Gold's are sitting around and Arnold's got this hat on and he's imitating somebody or something. Everybody's looking at him. Everybody's laughing. And it says, just then into the thick of this from somewhere out of the California afternoon wanders an alligator wrestler from Florida with a knife at his hip, looking perhaps like a real assassin. He seats himself carefully on the bodybuilder's grass, crosses his legs, and only then looks around. Plaintively at first, like a hit dog, his eyes rolling with dope. But then as he begins to focus on these people around him, and particularly on the unreal one with the hat, this alligator wrestler, this typical segment of the outside world, commences hysterically and uncompromisingly to stare. A few years ago, some inventive psychology course somewhere ran an experiment in alienation, in which a student was made to wear a paper bag over his head to class every day for a semester. At first, the other students were amused by the bag one, but after a few weeks, he began to get mysteriously on their nerves. And by the end of the semester, most of them confessed to feeling all-out hatred or terror for the son of a bitch in the sack. There are as few men built even remotely like Arnold as there are, say, Pavlovsky horses or Texas blind salamanders. And nothing in modern American life had prepared that gentleman from Florida for what he was confronted with. He found himself suddenly and hideously in the middle of a lawn full of people with bags over their heads, and all he knew to do was stare. He is not alone. Outside of Gold's Gym and Venice Beaches, almost the entire civilized world stares at bodybuilders, with disgust, with fright, with awe. And a few, like the girl who ran into Arnold in a bar the night before, with pure D ecstasy. She was backing out of the place, banging a tambourine in the company of four or five other stagettes out for this night on the town when she ran smack into the entering Arnold. He caught her. She turned to him, her head just above the level of his waist, and she began to feel him experimentally, as though he were the back wall of a cave. She felt, paused, felt a little higher. Jesus Christ, she shrieked at her friends. Come feel this. Look at this goddamn body. Arnold might have told her, look, I am the supreme example of an art form for which there is hardly an audience in this country. Or, what you are now feeling is a body. Yes, ma'am. But it is also an athletic product like Catfish Hunter's slider or Ken Rosewall's backhand, the results of years of disciplined and specialized training that you could not possibly appreciate fully until you've seen it on a stage doing what it does in competition. He could have said something like that, but instead he just grabbed back. She knew how to look, this girl, and a bodybuilder's whole world breaks cleanly as a saltine into those who know how to look and those who don't. All right, so that's part one of the book. Part two is called The Competition. So it starts off with chapter seven, and this is the biggest chapter in the whole book, and it was really interesting going over this book again. I really found it fascinating. Basically, this chapter talks about what bodybuilding is, and they even go into the history of the sport with Sigmund Klein, who was a great bodybuilder from the early 1900s. So here's a quote here from Sigmund. At the time, Sigmund was 73 years old back in 1973, 5'4½", 148 pounds. So this quote here says, I'd wear half a leotard. Sometimes I have a red one. I had different colors and Roman sandals. And I did, first I'd do the muscle posing, classical posing, muscle control, hand balancing, and then juggling of weights, kettlebells, dumbbells, and barbells. First you take them and you spin them from left to right. Then you reverse them, then a double spin. Then you throw it over your shoulder and you catch it in front of you. They'd weigh sometimes from 25 to 35 pounds, more heavier if you do them right. Then you take the kettlebell, throw it behind you and catch it over there. You go between your legs and you spin it and you catch it here. And then you learn other tricks with it. I'd often wind up by hanging it on my little finger and I'd have a kid hold a cardboard and I'd write my name, Klein, in black letters. All right, that was the kettlebell. Then with the dumbbell, you do other things. I'd swing it up, right? And I'd let it spin and catch it on the sphere. Now there'd be one sphere there on my hand, right? And the other one's way up on top. From there, I'd spin it and catch it on the handle. And then I'd throw it into this hand, then into that hand. Then I'd let it drop into the crook of the arm. I'd spin it around, catch it here, and do that several times. Then I'd spin it in front of me this way. Then I'd lift it up and put it behind my head on the shoulders. And then tilt it off and spin it around real fast. And with the barbell, I'd often take the whole barbell and rest the sphere on the palm of my hand and then press it up slowly. And that was quite a balancing stunt to hold that old barbell up there like that. All right. And then I want to read this part, which I thought was really, really interesting about the history of bodybuilding. So it says the history of bodybuilding, like that of any sport or art, is the history of the men who have bent and shaped it. And Sig Klein is one of them, one of the classics. 2 years ago in New York, just after he retired, he told me how he thought modern bodybuilding began, and it turned out to be a story about another one, a strong man who became the world's first physique artist. People say, well, when did systematic bodybuilding start? Well, the ancient Greeks had it, the ancient Chinese had it, but how it came to the so-called civilized world, if you want to call it that, which it isn't, is another story. I believe that it got its first big push in Prussia in 1811, at the time when the Prussians had been defeated by Napoleon and they were not allowed to arm their men anymore for battle. There was a man then by the name of Frederick Ludwig Jahn, who was a strict nationalist, and he said he was going to train men in physical culture to be able to defend themselves. Now, there were a lot of men that may not have been strong enough to do gymnastics, so he evolved this system of bodybuilding exercises with the weights, moderate weights. Now, some of these fellows liked the weights more than they did the gymnastics. It could be the truth, it may not be. Well, let's suppose that a lot of these men began to like the weights better than the gymnastics, and they started little clubs, and this spread all over Germany. Now, I got to come back to the story of Attila. Louis Attila was born in Baden-Baden in Germany in 1844. It's going quite back, a long time. He started in the theatrical field as a dance and song man when he was a young man. And in those days, they always had professional strongmen in these different vaudeville houses. And then, speculating again, here he meets a man by the name of Felice Napoli. Felice Napoli was born in Naples. That's where he took the professional name, Napoli, in 1820. And he was the finest performer there was of strongman feats. There were other strongmen, but never with the finesse that he had. Well, Attila wanted to get into the strongman profession, so he became an assistant to Napoli, and he learned the finest art of displaying feats of strength. Then later, Attila spread out for himself, and he became a very famous performer all over Europe. In 1887, at Queen Victoria's Jubilee, of all the strongmen in Europe that could have been selected, they selected him as the strongman to perform at Queen Victoria's Jubilee. He was presented by the Prince of Wales with a stick pin the size of a silver dollar, with a crystal painting of a little Hercules statue carved out of crystal, and 36 big diamonds around there. Later on, he had an audience at Buckingham Palace. He had royal families in Denmark taking lessons from him. He became world famous. Now, at the same time, there was a strongman act in London by the name of Samson and Cyclops. Samson, Charles Samson, claimed that he was the strongest man in the world, and he was constantly challenging everybody to come up on the stage and lift his weights. Attila was upset with this man. He knew him very well, and he knew that he was a braggart. Now, Attila had a school in Brussels, and he had some pupils from the Leiden University coming there, taking lessons from him, and one of them was an art student. And he said, "Professor, we have a model in our class that has the finest physique that I've ever seen." Well, the professor had heard these stories before, and he said, "Well, if he's as great as you say he is, bring him to me." And they brought a young man over to Attila's gymnasium, and his name was Frederick Mueller. And when Attila asked this young man to strip down, he was shocked and amazed at the beauty of this young man's form. Attila thought, "I'm going to train this young man, train him for a couple of years, and accept Samson's challenge." Then finally one day, Attila says, "We're ready." So they get into London, and Attila and this young man are in a box when Samson makes his usual every night challenge. And Attila jumps out on the stage, and he says, "I challenge you." Samson says, "You're going to challenge me?" He says, "No, not me. I'm challenging you for a pupil of mine." Attila brought the young man up on a stage. He had him dressed in evening clothes, beautiful blonde, curly hair. Samson started to laugh. He said, "This young man's going to beat me?" Attila says, "Yes, he is." Then he had him disrobe, and the audience went wild when they saw this beautiful, handsome, magnificent young man. He beat Samson, and his name was spread all over London, of course. And then another contest was arranged, and in England they were paying as high as $50 to $100 for a seat in a theater to see this contest, and the young man beat him again. This young man was the great Sandow, and that was the beginning of his career. Because of him, gymnasiums started up, people started to buy dumbbells all over England, and England became the big center of the strongman. Now, the strongmen came from all over Europe, over to England, to get into the act. Everybody wanted to make a fortune, and they all came to England, all the famous strongmen of Europe. And some of them were much stronger than Sandow, but none of them had the personality, the showmanship that Attila taught to Sandow. All right. Now, there used to be a firm here in New York that who were importers of big bands and big acts from Europe. And once they saw Sandow perform, they thought, maybe we can bring him to America and make some money. They convinced Sandow to come to this country, and then when they had him here, they didn't know what to do with him. But there was a young man that was getting into show business at the time by the name of Florin Ziegfeld. The firm contacted him, and they sold him Sandow's contract, and they thought they were glad to be rid of him. This was in 1893 at the Chicago World's Fair. But Ziegfeld had a real showmanship instinct. He took Sandow to Chicago, publicized him as the strongest man in the world, made him more famous than he'd ever been, and all over the country, the dumbbells became popular. And that was it. That was how bodybuilding really began over here. All right, so that was great. So then to go more into the beginning of bodybuilding in this chapter, including talking about Bernard McFadden, who started his own mail order course, and then Charles Atlas, who was originally called Angelo Siciliano. And then they go into the 40s and 50s, and they talk about how the AAU started. And then, of course, Weider and Joe and Ben Weider from Montreal challenged them, and then they started all the different organizations. So here it says, of the publisher businessmen who succeeded Bernard McFadden as the contest sponsors and general promoters of the sport, there were and still are three primary ones. Bob Hoffman, a weightlifting coach and AAU official who publishes two muscle magazines and owns York Barbell Company and a subsidiary that sells health foods and supplements. Joe Weider, the Canadian who lives in California and whose Weider Enterprises also controls two magazines and a barbell and food products company, and a former CBS SEAL test strongman named Dan Laurie, who does roughly the same things in a smaller way and heads a professional bodybuilding organization called the World Bodybuilding Guild. Charles Atlas himself might be amazed at the size of the business these guys do. The domestic and foreign circulation of the Weider magazines, for instance, is over 1 million. And the yearly advertising budget for only one of Weider's dozens of products, a cable body shaper, is nearly $3 million. All of them become wealthy because of bodybuilding. All of them sell their company's products through their respective magazines. And all of them use bodybuilders or ex-bodybuilders to advertise those products. Given all of that in common, you'd think they'd have a lot to say to each other. But the fact is, and it is a damaging fact to bodybuilding, they don't. And whatever they have to say about each other generally falls into the category of slander. All right, so that's a fantastic chapter. Really talks a lot about the history of the bodybuilding and about bodybuilding in general. All right, now we go to chapter 8, and that is Mr. Olympia number 3. So this basically is a very short chapter. It's only 4 pages, and it basically talks about the prejudging of the Mr. Olympia. So now we're at the contest. We're away from Venice Beach. We're away from Gold's Gym, and now we're actually in New York at the contest. And it's got a couple of quotes here from Franco, because I think it talks mostly about Franco's posing. He says, "When I'm on stage, I control everybody down there in the audience. I'm very secure about myself, and I think I am much higher than anybody there because I'm on the stage doing the work, and they are watching me. They paid to see me, and I'm very confident. Very, very confident. And I show much possibility. I'm not afraid of anything. I am very secure." And then Franco says, "I wasn't thinking about anything or anybody in particular. I was thinking about all of them. What I was really thinking in the moments when I was doing one pose and they applaud so much, and then my mind was really with the next pose, thinking I'm going to do more. I'm going to hit it even harder, and the next one's more hard, until they're so convincing and they would scream more and more and more until they couldn't take it anymore." All right, chapter 9 is basically about the competitions. And so it starts off talking about Ed Jubenville's contest in Holyoke, Massachusetts, which was held outside at the Mountain Park Pavilion. So they talk a lot about that. They got a lot of pictures about that. And then it goes into the prejudging, again, of the Mr. Olympia. And I think it talks a little bit more about Arnold. So the first quote here in chapter 9 is from Mike Katz. It says, "I wouldn't want a woman that would have married me because of my physique or was a sex maniac who just was a body freak, a body queen who was just interested in rubbing suntan oil on me and getting all hot and bothered every time she looked at me. You know, my wife is interested in personality. She's interested in the real humanness of a person. We don't sit there with her admiring my physique, you know, and drooling and waiting to get to bed with me." So yeah, I have a lot of great pictures of this Mr. East Coast, which again was held at the Mountain Park in Holyoke. And they have a picture of Franklin Green right here. So we're just talking about Franklin. All right, the next quote in this chapter is from Steve Mihalik. And Steve says, "Winning Mr. America is a tremendous responsibility. Even having muscles is a tremendous responsibility. People look up to you. They think you're some sort of a special person. And you always have to seem to feel that way too, whether you do or not. You start looking at people, whether they're inferior to you, maybe no other way but physically, that no matter how they treat you or feel about you, you always have the muscles there." All right, there's a quote here from Tony Roma, who was one of the competitors in the Mr. East Coast contest in Holyoke. He said, "If another man can do it, so can I, and I'm going to do it. I don't care how much work it takes. Work doesn't bother me. She knows. I work hard. I go through pain, unbelievable suffering, and I love every minute of it. Not because you like it, you don't enjoy it, but somehow you want to feel that pain in order to know that you're having a good workout. Believe me, it's hard work. I don't think there's any sport in the world, anything in the world, that takes so much pain and so much struggle and so much motivation. And the man that can stand this can achieve the top." And then there's a quote here from Arnold. And this is, again, was used in the movie Pumping Iron as well. Arnold says, "On stage, I'm always different than off stage. I can be very friendly off stage, but on stage, I will pull one trick after another on my competition to wipe him out, you know, because it's my living and I have to win. Franco is my best friend, but I will do as much as I can to make him look bad and me look good." And then another quote here from Mihalik. "I've had phone calls, letters, and personal approaches. How they got my number, I'll never know, but they want you. They're going to get you. And I had phone calls from people And maybe I'm stupid because I would not act offended toward these people because I felt they are human beings as well as I am. And I will just explain to them, well, this isn't my bag. If you're interested in developing your body, I'll help you. But as far as anything else goes, I'm not interested. But maybe the word got around that I was a softie, you know, who knows? So then I get calls and calls and the letters came. Steve, send me photographs of you in leather pants. Steve, send me photographs of you with nothing on. I'll pay any price. I'll pay any price. I'll pay anything. If I wasn't married and I was a homosexual, I could be living for nothing, putting my entire salary away. I could have any car I want. I could be living in, I've had offers to live in Maine. I've had offers to live on Fire Island. I've had offers to live in people's apartments on 86th Street down there, which is a fantastic neighborhood. All right. So that was the quotes for this chapter. And this is a pretty long chapter as well. This is 37 pages. So this was actually the longest chapter in the book, longer than that other one. And then there's one more quote here from Tony Romo. It says, there's something in any man that wants to be above the average. A bodybuilder is actually the most in perfection of the human body. You want to reach the perfection. To be that sets you apart from the average man. It sets you apart. You are looked up to and respected. I think we do it because it takes a lot of courage and we dare step out of the regular routine. Not many people dare. We really go down to the limit and that sets you apart. We go through all this struggle and all this pain, you know, and this is what makes me proud. I can do other things in life much easier. Okay. And then there's another section in this chapter I want to read. Charles Gaines brought with him to the prejudging of the Mr. Olympia, Mr. America, Mr. World. He brought a friend of his. Her name was Virginia. I don't think this was his wife. It might have been someone he was dating. I'm not sure. But I think it was just a friend of his. Charles had a lot of friends who were from the intellectual part of the world, I guess, writers and photographers and different people like that. And she was completely unfamiliar with bodybuilding, knew nothing about it, as most people did not back then. So he brought her to this contest and he talks about this conversation he had with her. And I thought this was really fascinating and kind of entertaining, where Virginia really gets into it. And it also goes to show you how beautiful I think the sport was back then, how raw it was, how real it was, not quite like it is today. So I'm going to read this passage from this chapter. It says, then after the Mr. World, the judges called a break. The prejudging had been going on for nearly 2 hours. After the break, they would prejudge Serge Nubre, Franco, and Arnold for the Mr. Olympia title. Then they would break again for 2 or 3 hours this time before the show would begin at 8 o'clock. That night, the Academy, Brooklyn Academy of Music, would be aisle full of Raouls, whistlers, screamers, moaners, and booers, a nitroglycerin Academy crowd that can chill or frenzy on a second. Each competitor then would have a minute or two before them under the spot on the posing dais. The very best ones and the local favorites like Franklin Green would be met there and followed through their routines by an unimaginable din, an urgent rhythmic pandemonium that would break some of them into sweaty, glazed-eyed transports on the dais and bring others close to tears. And a few, the inexplicable and ridiculous few who shouldn't be there in the first place, but always are, the ones with no muscle and the ones who can't pose and the ones who come out with erections, would leave the dais feeling sorry they were in Brooklyn that evening. Right now, except for some talking on the stage, the place was quiet. Virginia and I walked to the back again for her to smoke. Do they tell who won? Not till tonight after the show. Nobody but the judges knows until then. But it looks like Ferrigno in the America and Ken Waller in the World. What do you think? I'd like it better if there weren't so many of them. So would I. Like maybe 5 in each height thing and just the best ones. The ones who aren't so good kind of blur the good ones or something. I know they ought to screen for the big contest, but they don't. It's one of the things they have to improve on. There are some others too. But Jesus God, the posing Charles, that Leon guy is fantastic. And the ones from that place in California and your friend Corny, did you see me when he got through? I couldn't blink my eyes. It was like they were frozen open. His hands and everything, the way he moves. Yeah, he's just had a bad knee operation. He wasn't in the shape that he usually is. It's like ballet, isn't it? The best ones, I mean. Sort of, but you haven't seen the best ones yet. Ed usually is, but he wasn't on this time. You know what it reminded me of? of Elizabethan music. No, really, a whole lot. I kept thinking of it while I was watching. You know, those songs, how they're raunchy and elegant and massive and delicate and surprising all at the same time. And sweet. Stop it. That's just what Corny made me think of. And a few of the others. And also of horses. Tennessee walking horses I used to see at shows in Winchester. Well, I'm glad you liked it. Their thighs look like horses. Do you have thighs like that? No. Look, are you getting tired? They even look like they eat alfalfa and clover. And the way they move. Virginia, what? You better find something to hang on to for these last three. I haven't seen anything, huh? Well, you've seen something, but there's a lot you haven't seen. And of course, those last three were Serge Nubre, Franco, and Arnold. All right. Chapter 10 is the Mr. Universe number 3. And this, of course, has the picture of Ed Corny, which is the same one as the cover of the book where he's got his arms overhead in victory. And this talks about the finals of the Mr. Universe contest. So this was great. Really, really great chapter. Really great ending to all the other chapters that preceded it. So now we see Ed finally win after all he's been through. And then, of course, Mike Katz got second place. So this was a great chapter. And she has a lot of great pictures of Ed and Mike walking through the streets. People going crazy. The crowd's just rushing them and stuff. So great stuff. All right. Chapter 11 is 11 pages. This is about posing. And I thought this was great stuff, too. Really great writing by Charles Gaines. All right, so in Chapter 10, I'm going to read the quotes here that are on the side of the pages. And the first one comes from Mike Katz. He says, I don't want to die just another slob with my name on a gravestone someplace. I want to die with my name somewhere at the top. Make a little dent in the sport. I'm in so that maybe 40 years from now, people will say, hey, that guy was Mr. America. That would give me enough happiness to die with a smile on my face. Wow. Well, that's so cool that Mike was in the movie Pumping Iron, because I think people still do remember Mike from that movie. And it's been more than 40 years, right? Since 72. And, of course, people still do remember Mike Katz. All right, this one again is from Mike Katz. He says, I won't do anything else until I win Mr. Universe. If I have to train 10 years, I'm going to win it. I don't know why I say that, because the education is just as important. But I could not be happy right now going out as a loser. I placed third in the Mr. Universe last year. If I went out as a loser, it would make the 10 years I've spent in bodybuilding a complete waste. Of course, Mike never did win the universe, but he did win the Mr. World, and he turned pro in 1976. So 1975 was the year that Pumping Iron was filmed, and Mike unfortunately only got sixth that year in the Mr. Universe. Or sixth, or was he fourth? No, I think it was fourth. Because the top three were Waller, Roger Walker, and Paul Grant. And I think Mike was right after that. Okay, chapter 11 is not about the universe or about the Olympia. It is about posing. It doesn't have any, it just says 11. There's no title to it. So Charles Gaines talks about posing. So I want to read some of this from the chapter as well, because I thought it was really, really well written and really interesting. And I think Charles really nailed how important posing is. So it starts off saying, posing is the heart of the thing. Depending on how it is done, you can see in it either everything that is moving and beautiful and dignified about the display of a developed male body, or everything that is ridiculous and embarrassing about it. On its lowest level, posing is simply a technical matter of presenting the muscles, of emphasizing strong points and obscuring weak ones. And just beyond that, it is an athletic skill, like diving or hitting a baseball, that requires timing and coordination. The greatest majority of bodybuilders never get beyond the point of athletic competence in their posing. Many do not even get there. And they, no matter how well developed, are always embarrassing to watch. The ones who are only competent can be interesting for one reason or another to see work, but one time is usually enough and you're hardly ever moved by them. But on its highest, most expressive level, as it is done by only a handful of people, physique posing is a kinetic form of art, requiring talent, imaginative and personal, turning on intuition, and no matter how many times you watch it performed there, is always something new you can learn and feel from it. Good posing, even great posing, is only so much movement, however interesting, unless it is displaying a first-rate physique. The physique gives the posing meaning. The posing gives expression to the physique. and the two have got to be equally finished and appropriate to each other for a routine to really grab and shake you the way the best ones can. When they are, there is nothing even remotely embarrassing or ridiculous in what you see. And then Charles says, just as important as the poses themselves is the movement connecting them. All the best posing is an equal mixture of drama and grace, and it is the transitions that supply most of the grace. The movement in this routine would be unhurried, virile, smooth, carrying the body off the line of one pose just before the muscles began to quiver from the strain of holding it, naturally and forcefully to the next. You would see no hesitation or thought of, no stumbling or readjustment or compensation. All you would see is clear, lovely shifts, plunges and sweeps, some of them protracted and long-lined, others as choppy and brief as body punches, setting up the poses and carrying out of them again in what you would seem to you the only possible way there is to do it. A sense of things being done and the only way they can be done is one of the things you would feel watching the routine. Another is the clarity and impersonality of it. During very good posing, you don't notice a bodybuilder's face any more than you do the color of his trunks. Neither do you, unless you are very new to the watching, wonder what kind of man he is or what he does for a living or what his problems might be. In the AAU, the judges interview each of the Mr. America contestants before the competition, and the title is awarded partially on the basis of what they decide about, his character or charm, some Atlantic City qualification that has nothing to do with what he is there for. This practice demeans bodybuilding competition and violates one of the things that is most unique and real about it, the fact that when both physique and posing are good enough, they force the spectator to concentrate on a clean, impersonal, exciting geometry of circles and curves and on the movement tying it together, and to forget completely that it is a greased, nearly naked man with charm or without who is showing it to you. The best posing is also completely without affectation or mannerisms, the way it was done by Grimmick and Ross and Pearl and Scott, and the way it is done now by Arnold Schwarzenegger, Franco Colombo, Ed Corney, and a few others. It seems like all good art, artless. It isn't, of course. It is very highly contrived, but contrived in a way that blends grace and drama without any obtrusive magnification of either. That is the old way, the classic way. And in Corney and Schwarzenegger, it may have reached its apogee. And then Charles continues with his friend Virginia at the end of this chapter. He says, Arnold Schwarzenegger finished his routine and the Olympia prejudging with a crab shot that sent Raul into a frenzy of language behind us. Arnold grinned at the judges. It was the first time he had looked directly at them since he began, and he left the stage without looking back, wiping down his shoulders and chest the way you do the flank of a lathered horse. Virginia and I sat for a couple of minutes without talking, she chewing on her lower lip and watching the ring of dampness that Arnold had left behind on the stage. We had just seen a posing routine. In fact, we had seen three, his, Franco's, and Serge Nubre's, any one of which could serve on film, say, as a wordless definition of what bodybuilding is all about. Virginia shifted and laid her head back on the seat. It was the first move I'd seen her make in 15 minutes. Why aren't they famous? Why doesn't everybody know about this? They just haven't gotten around to it, and bodybuilding has given itself a rotten press. You ready to go? It's 5:30. I feel like I was just hit in the eyes with a goddamn axe. Well, he'd like to hear that. Why don't we go backstage and you can tell him that? No, I don't want to meet him. Just dream about him. It's sad, Charles, that more people don't know. When you see it like that, there's nothing, you know, dingy about it or it-ish or vain or any of those things I thought it would be. The best ones do that for you. When they pose, they cut right through all the myths and the bad organization and the tacky magazines. All that chalky feet stuff, and they show you what the thing is really like. Chalky feet stuff? It's just something I remember from when I first started going to these things. Did you like them then? Not at first. I didn't know how to look as well as you do. We better move it if you're going out. They must be awfully lonely, doing that beautiful thing and nobody around to appreciate it. Well, there are people around who do. There'll be a couple of thousand of them here tonight. I stood up and handed Virginia her coat. She took it, but she didn't get up. She sat there with her lovely head on the back of the seat, looking up at me. Will he be that good tonight? Maybe better. The Yolk loves an audience. I decided I'm going to come. She stood up then and put on her coat. I thought you couldn't. I can. We walked up the aisle toward the dark front of the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Down on the stage, they were setting up for the show. The bodybuilders would have a couple hours now to go out and eat something and get something careful to eat, although most of them probably wouldn't. Charles, said Virginia, you know what I said about that Elizabethan music? Well, that was dumb. It's not a bit like that. Not at all. All right. And then the last chapter is Mr. Olympia number 4. And of course, this is the finals of the Mr. Olympia where Arnold wins the 1973 Mr. Olympia. So we got some great quotes here. All right. The first one is from Arnold. It says, I find out which poses they really like. That's why I don't have a specific posing routine, because you never know what they like and what they don't. Sometimes you think a routine is good, but the applause is going down. Like Franco explained, he did one shot coming up for tricep from the side and the sound went down, so he cut the shot. You have to be very flexible in these things. You have to listen. When you hit a most muscular and they start screaming, you know, they just like the more freaky poses, so you just keep hitting it again and maybe hold it longer to get the cuts out more. You know, then they like the drama shots and you can forget the symmetrical stuff. And then Tony Romo again. Not many bodybuilders dress up the way we do. The reason I dress up, it really makes me proud. And Natalie, I have my clothes tailored for myself, and I like to show. It's like you have a collection, and it's part of you, and you like to show people. It's my hard work to keep my body in shape, and hers. We like to dress up, and we like to show. We go to a place, and people talk and turn, and they laugh about it, and some of them make jokes about it, and all this makes us feel even more proud of it. There's no better thing than working with something that you really own. I can have a beautiful racing car and somebody can steal it, but your body is the only thing you really own. And then his wife, Natalie Raposa, was also quoted here. Tony goes with me to the ladies' stores because I like him to tell me what clothes I should put on. And they just laugh and laugh because they just can't stand the bodybuilders. And we, in turn, we laugh at them because we know that that's so lousy. We just laugh at them. It's a ball. I have a ball every time we go out. Every place we go, everybody stares at us like we're men from Mars or something like that. I think bodybuilding is a great thing. I'm really into it all the way, you know. I like watching men work out, and I help Tony all the time. I sit on his back for donkey calf raises. I give him incentive. So wild how bodybuilding was just so unusual. Like, nobody even worked out. Nobody ever saw anybody with muscles. And when they did, they just laughed at it. All right, so that's all the quotes from this chapter, but I did want to read a little bit of Charles' writing again about Arnold. Okay, so this is actually what ends the book. This is the ending of the book. So what happens is this. In the madness of noise, an ear-splitting, wall-shaking tumult of noise, he takes the stage, his face radiant, and he shows the audience and judges a single leg. It is a leg he injured a few months earlier when a posing platform in South Africa collapsed with him, and he wants them to see that it is as good as ever. He turns it languidly, showing the elegant complexity of his calf. Then he cuts to a front double bicep, a pose that shows the entire front of the body, from zoom to pan, from detail to mind-blowing hole. It's as sharp and right as that kick outside the hotel, and it impales the crowd. A sort of moaning begins out front, as they take in the softball-sized biceps, the long, deep pectoral slabs, the yawning latissimus dorsi, all that carved, intricate bulk at once. He holds it, his body straight, his arms flexed at shoulder height, a pure, lovely, demanding pose that demonstrates both his size and symmetry at once. From there, he goes in a crunch of arms to a most muscular, turning his chest, arms, and shoulders into an anatomy chart display of veins and cuts, and maddening the audience. Then to his own three-quarter back shot, a one-arm side back, a back double bicep, a side back with the other arm, each movement long, pure, uncluttered. It is posing at its driest and shapeliest, mixing grace and drama without cheating or excess and with no taint of the effort or the grotesque. It makes you feel in the dignity and beauty of its finish that you have never watched posing before. As he lays these perfect poses on the crowd, the luck and strain and glamour and joy of doing it are right there up on Arnold's face, all over his features. No preoccupation here, Jack. No dark, motivated, new British absence of expression here. He is as into this as the ravening crowd, glistening, flexing, swooping from shot to marvelous shot. These are his people, and this is his thing, at his moment. He is Nureyev in London, Caruso at La Scala, Babe Ruth at Wrigley Field pointing his bat, a king with a court at the top of his art. When he finishes with another most muscular, throws up his hands and bounds off the dais out of the spotlight, the deafening mixture of screaming, moaning, and applause that has not sagged, not once, since he came out, takes on a strangely wretched quality, almost of lament. Nearly to the stage exit, Arnold stops in the half dark. He listens to the audience, his head cocked, smiling in the shadows. Then he looks back at the dais, hesitates, and returns. The end. So that was the book, Pumping Iron. I hope you guys enjoyed the little excerpts and all the quotes from the book. If you have not ever read this book, I encourage you to definitely get it. Like I said, it is now available on Amazon for only $20. It is reprinted, and they have a new introduction, I believe, from Charles Gaines and Arnold at the beginning of the book. It is now, let's see, it is over 50 years old. I think they came out with the new printing of it last year on the 50-year anniversary. So amazing book. I reread it all the time. I love it. It's one of the best books ever on the sport of bodybuilding. And this is the book that introduced the public world to bodybuilding. And it was a bestseller. It was a huge bestseller. And then, of course, they made the movie 2 years later. Well, they made the movie in 1975. It came out in 1977. And then this book was made, well, they were writing about it in 72 and 73, and then it was released in 74. So the movie and the book really changed the sport. And looking back at it now and reading this book 50 years later, you really capture how bodybuilding was and how special it was. It was a small cult sport. Not many people worked out back then. Not many people knew about it, but it really had a lot of heart and soul, something I think is kind of lacking now because it's gotten so much bigger. And with all the different classes, they just introduced a lot of more regular people to the sport. And of course, everybody works out now. There's gyms all over. So the sport has gone through many, many changes. But back then it was more raw, more real, more heart and soul, I guess. And I was lucky to see a lot of it when I got into bodybuilding in the late 70s. So this book really, really captures it. All right, guys. Well, I hope you enjoyed the show, and we will be back hopefully next week with another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you again to all our Patreon sponsors who continue to sponsor the podcast each week. We have been going for 6 years now and could not do it without you guys. If anyone out there is interested in becoming a Patreon sponsor, just go to our website, which is bodybuildinglegendsshow.com. And in the upper right hand corner, you'll see the link to becoming a Patreon sponsor. Or you can check the link below in the description. All right, guys, stay safe out there. Keep working out hard, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.